One of them I mentioned yesterday. The idea that if you and I take a minimalist approach to Islam, I worship Allah, I obey Him, but Allah, in my eyes, practically speaking, isn't Kabir, because He can't be if the dunya is very big for me. What happens? One of the things that I mentioned yesterday was that as a believer, I get fixated on the results of my actions. Whereas someone who considers Allah to be Kabir and Azim, that person says, Allah is my goal. Why do I do everything that I do in life? Because I want Allah. And He's everything. The results that all of us, we're working for results, we're expecting results. The Ahlul Bayt have taught us that. You make, Imam Sadiq, you make dua, expect that the haja is at the door. The Ahlul Bayt told me to do that. I hope for those results. But if a person has ikhlas, if a person thinks Allah is azim and kabir, then the results are what we call nurun ala nur, light upon light. Great, if the results get there. Otherwise, I got what I was looking for. I got Allah. I want to give you an example. This might not be a complete example, but just for you and I to know. If Allah is kabir, if Allah is azim, if I have Quranic ikhlas, and I've done something that pleased Allah. Question. When you and I step out outside, you step outside in a bright day, and the sun is out. The sun is out. Can you even see the stars? The stars are out there. But can you see the stars? If Allah is Ali, if Allah is everything, yeah, I get the results, alhamdulillah, because Allah said be grateful. That's different than being turned inside out if I don't get the results that I want. Example. And this, I'm speaking to myself. I'm not speaking from cloud nine. All of us are trying to reform ourselves to get ready for the Mahdi. Example. I went for ziyarah. I went under the very dome of Aba Abdullah. I held on to the dhari. And I asked Allah, and du'as are answered. Du'as are answered. But you know what? The reality is, my prayer up until now hasn't been answered. If I'm an ordinary Muslim, a mediocre Muslim, an average Muslim, I might start to, if I don't, I might not ever say this out loud, I'm a little disappointed with Allah. I made dua. I went for ziyarah. It didn't happen. Because as an average Muslim, the results are important. My dua, was my dua answered? If my dua is answered, then I'm happy. That's very different from where Allah's trying to take us. Brothers and sisters, there's a secret. Allah wants mu'mineen and mu'minat to enjoy their life here. To really enjoy it. Not put on a face. Not I'm fronting, I'm faking. To really deep down enjoy their lives. First in the dunya. And then in the akhirah. The secret is, it's impossible to do without ikhlas. It's without Allah being azim. I won't be able to get all those wonderful things that Allah wants the mu'min to have. He doesn't want me to just, I'm scraping by, if I just make it, if I don't go to hell. That's a minimalist approach to Islam. Allah wants us to enjoy ourselves. But that can't happen if I don't crack the code. Cracking the code means I see Allah as azim. So now, What else happens to the mu'min? Right? The mu'min who doesn't have ikhlas. Now, I want to mention one more verse of the Quran before I move on, right? Just to, for us to again demonstrate and drive home that point. The idea, the first point is the idea that the mu'min is frustrated. I didn't get, life wasn't fair. Even if I'm scraping by and I'm doing the right things. But Allah isn't azim. Ayat of Quran. Brothers and sisters, can you turn with me to Surah 9 and verse number 72? If you can turn with me to 972, this verse will explain to us that a person who's a mediocre mu'min has missed the point. I'm so focused and fixated on the results, I missed the point. So I don't go through life with a lot of joy. A verse of Quran. A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Guys, do you see this? Wa'ada Allahu al-mu'minina wal-mu'minat. Let's read this together. A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Wa'ada Allahu al-mu'minina wal-mu'minat. Allah has promised the believing men and the believing women jannat tajri min tahtiha al-anhar. Allah has promised us gardens beneath which rivers flow. Khalidina fiha. We will be in those gardens of paradise forever. What else? وَمَسَاكِنَ طَيِّبًا. Houses, dwellings, abodes, which are so wonderful. مَسَاكِنَ طَيِّبًا فِي جَنَّاتِ عَدْنٍ. And we will be in these gardens of perpetuity. We never have to worry about anything. But then Allah says the secret. وَرِضْوَانٌ مِّنَ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرٌ. Those are wonderful. But Allah's so much better. Should I be focused on the results? I want paradise. I don't want to go to hell. Or is there more? And it's just so much more wonderful. It's not that I won't get paradise. I'll get paradise. But there's something loftier. Something indescribable. Something Allah just says vaguely in the Quran. He says, وَرِضْوَانٌ مِّنَ اللَّهِ Akbar, the pleasure of God is so much greater. Why settle for a minimalist approach to Islam where I'm just focused on my results and I'm not happy? And he says, ذَلِكَ هُوَ الْفَوْزُ الْعَظِيمُ. That is the great success.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
You can talk it down, turn the other way, feel the truth. But it won't go away. Can you hear it calling? Yeah. You can write it down, but nobody. untold story of our biggest fears. It can reach you with no warning. Yeah, yeah. When the sun there's a part of me that won't understand, having sleepless nights with my head in my hands. I'm here and tears are falling, yeah. If I could right the wrongs, would you lend me your hand? I would make a difference to this beautiful land. If I'm nothing, I have my intention. When the sun goes down and there's nothing left around, can you feel it? Can you feel it? When your knees are on the ground, you may fear but it's allowed. Are you listening? 'Cause I need forgiving. I need
storytellers who go beyond the boundaries of conventional filmmaking to capture the soul of reality, unveiling moments that are raw, unfiltered, and profoundly impactful. These filmmakers use their craft to explore the complexities of culture, history, and human emotion. My guest today is a documentary filmmaker who has dedicated his lens to capturing the untold stories of resilience, tradition, and transformation in a rapidly evolving world. He brings to light the perspectives and voices that might otherwise go unheard. Welcome to Saul. I am Bahandura, your host.
Zhang Zhong is a media personality whose creative work centers on three key pillars: preserving and promoting Chinese culture and traditions, such as Peking Opera and other classical performances, exploring fundamental societal issues within China across diverse social layers, and fostering international collaborations, having worked with countries like North Korea, Iran, Japan, and France. His multifaceted approach reflects a deep commitment to cultural dialogue, social insight, and global exchange.
Mr. Zhang Zhong, it's a pleasure to have you on Soul.
I'm very happy to be your guest on this program.
Thank you. Has there been any moment in your professional filmmaking experience that you were so affected by the subject that you were deeply involved and couldn't go on anymore, or you had to stop for a moment and then kind of retrack the path that you had taken?
I've had many experiences like this. Once in China, I was directing a war film about a soldier who loses his leg in battle. While I was directing the scene, even even though I knew it was fictional, I stepped aside and started crying out loud. I felt as if I were that soldier, standing on the battlefield myself. During this festival, I've cried watching many of the films too. Even when we know something is staged or a short film, the scenes can still move us deeply. As a director, if I'm not emotionally affected myself, how can I create something that moves others and stirs their emotions?
And of course, Bill, you've had experience with international filmmaking as well, and you are involved in productions. What kind of co-productions internationally interest you?
I'm truly passionate about Iranian cinema. Back in China, during my teaching career, I included Iranian cinema in my courses, sometimes as an elective, sometimes as a required subject. I've even designed a special module focused entirely on Iranian film. In my view, Iranian cinema is outstanding in terms of its themes, subject choices, production quality, and acting. It has a strong impact internationally, both artistically and in terms of content. This time, during my visit to Iran, in addition to our previous collaborative projects, I'm currently in talks with Iranian teams to produce our second joint film. And I hope you can support me in connecting with and collaborating with Iranian filmmakers so that together we can create something truly special.
Right, of course I'm going to get back to the cultural side of your work, of course, later on in the conversation. But right now, I just wanted to know, to complete my previous question, if there's ever been any moment that you left any project unfinished, only to come back later on, maybe months later, maybe years later, to complete it with a different perspective?
It's a really meaningful experience, and I believe perseverance is what matters most. Of course, reaching this kind of experience isn't easy. It takes long-term dedication. First, you have to stay committed and believe that your work will succeed. I have a film that took 16 years to complete. Back then, I was still a graduate student, and I only just finished it this year. So, yes, perseverance is incredibly important, and you have to trust yourself. Whether it's been a few days, a month, a year, or even 10 years into a project, you need to believe that you can see it through to the end.
Right, very interesting. Now I'm going to talk about the cultural and the global perspectives, of course, regarding your projects. Tell me first, what role does Chinese history and culture play in shaping your documentaries?
I believe that film and visual media are a form of art, something you can see, hear, and truly experience. Traditional Chinese culture has had a profound influence on both my creative work and my personal growth. As I mentioned earlier, I pay close attention to Chinese proverbs and golden sayings, as well as traditional performances like Chuanju or Sichuan opera and other classical Chinese theatrical arts. In addition to that, I am deeply interested in themes related to governance, development, and the revival of Chinese culture. That's why many of my works have been able to document different historical periods in China. Each piece, in its own way, reflects the themes and characteristics of its respective era.
Right. Now I want to discuss, like, when it comes to international co-productions, imagine you talked about the proximity of the cultures of Iran and China. These are two countries that both have long history of traditions, so that is easier to work with that kind of culture. The other thing I want to know, imagine that you're kind of offered to make a co-production with a country that doesn't necessarily have that same proximity of culture with China. How would you approach finding the common grounds with a totally new and different culture?
Actually, the human heart is like a peach. Hearts connect with one another. Even if I don't understand your language and you don't understand mine, it's enough for our hearts to be in sync, for our spirits to connect, and for our eyes to speak to each other. I believe that when that happens, all problems can be resolved. For example, when I was working with the Iranian team during the filming process, we faced exactly these kinds of challenges, like language barriers, cultural differences, different working styles and approaches. But in the end, after just a short period of time, we were able to collaborate, communicate, write the script together, and complete our designs. There were no problems, just shared purpose.
Right. And how do you hope your films and productions kind of help the global audience to have a better understanding of China?
In essence, philosophy pays the deepest attention to the fundamental questions of human existence. Our documentaries, whether they explore major themes, embrace realism, or take on other forms, are all centered around human experiences. I believe there's a close connection between these elements, and they can strengthen and support one another. I often draw on philosophical thinking throughout the creative process when reviewing a script, reflecting on life, or evaluating my films and my work. Through different philosophies and ways of thinking, people gradually strive for a better life and more beautiful creations. To me, documentary film, philosophy, and human life should coexist. They're all present with us, not far away as they may seem, but in fact very close.
Right. Well, Mr. Zhang, I know that you are also a university professor, and you, one of the fields that you teach in university is philosophy, if I'm right. I want to know, what is your philosophical approach to documentary filmmaking and cinema in general?
That's a great question. I believe that whether on a global scale or within individual countries, everyone hopes for peace. The world is like a family, and just like in any family, people wish for peace. Of course, even within families, there are disagreements and conflicts between spouses, children, or parents. Similarly, at the level of nations and the world as a whole, misunderstandings and disputes are natural and unavoidable. But I believe, deep down, people truly desire peace. Even in places like the United States, I'm convinced that over time and through the efforts of each of us, including those working in digital media, film, and documentary, we can move closer to peace. And I believe art can play a powerful role in that journey.
Right. My other question regarding culture and international situation in cinema is that, well, we are living in a world of turmoil and political ups and downs nowadays, to say the least, of course. But the situation that we have in the Middle East, the situation in Gaza and Palestine, and also, of course, with Donald Trump in office at the US and his tariffs, and the tariff war with China. How do you think art, culture, can make a difference and can kind of bring the cultures together a little bit more in order to create a better balance in world affairs and change this situation for the better?
这个问题很好，我想的是，无论是
making a documentary is incredibly challenging, whether you're the director, the cinematographer, or the host. It's demanding work, and it doesn't bring in much income. It often takes a long time, sometimes a month, 2 months, a year, 2 years, or even 10 years. Many documentary filmmakers, myself included, have lived modest and challenging lives. Securing enough funding and financial support is extremely hard. And beyond that, many people struggle to keep going because even the early stages of finding resources for a documentary are a major challenge. That's the biggest obstacle documentary filmmakers face.
Of course, one of the most important questions in documentary cinema is the question of funding, which is kind of the thing that guarantees sustainability of a documentary maker's career. How do you fund your projects?
As a filmmaker and documentarian, I often have a very low income. Many times I've had to fund projects out of my own pocket. And I've even borrowed money from my spouse on occasion, unlike some directors who might earn millions from a single film. Our earnings are quite modest. Still, choosing my own path matters deeply to me. I could have made films that were more commercially successful, but I prefer to work on projects that may not generate much income, because the subjects and communities I focus on deserve the attention of a responsible and committed director.
Right. Well, Mrs. Zhang, you're right now a jury member at the Soap Media Festival, of course, the third edition of it. How do you think necessary are such occasions and such festivals for documentary cinema, and especially certain types of documentary cinema that are being screened and taken care of and supported with this festival?
This was my first time visiting Iran and Tehran and participating in the Soap Media Festival. Before traveling from China, I went to the Iranian embassy there and met with the cultural attaché, who gave me detailed information about the festival and the related international news. During the events, I also served as a jury member and watched many works. When I arrived in Iran, I was welcomed with such warmth and sincerity. It felt just like being greeted by family. From the very first day through to the opening ceremony, the team's meticulous planning and attention to detail truly impressed me and left a lasting impact. In my opinion, the Soap Festival has three key strengths that highlight its importance. First, its international scope with participants from dozens of countries, filmmakers, producers, and cinema professionals all gathered in Tehran, and everyone seemed genuinely happy and satisfied. Second, the selection of topics. The festival focuses on clear and meaningful themes. For example, this year it featured a special section on Palestine, which was very well done. And third is growth and outreach. I hope the festival can expand its activities in China and attract more attention from Chinese audiences and the global community, so it can evolve into an even more prominent international platform. Right. Well, I don't know if you've started your filmmaking career with analog cinema and then moved on to digital, but I want to, generally speaking, know your opinion on the role of technology, new technology on cinema, the kind of change
it has brought with it to these documentary type of cinema?
That's a really good question. In fact, many TV networks in China no longer use human robots. Most of them now rely on robotic presenters. Even for Chinese hosts themselves, the job has become increasingly challenging. In our creative team, we often use cutting-edge AI technologies, including both domestic and international software, even some that are available in Iran. Now, we have a large number of virtual hosts and digital humans. In my creative work, for example, when designing a closed scene or a set, we used to have to build and execute everything manually. It used to take 2 to 3 months, sometimes even half a month at best. But now, it can be done in about a week. In the visual projects I'm currently working on, the entire film is ready even before shooting begins. Cinematographers can preview camera positions, actors can see how their performances will look, and the set design is already complete. As I've said before, I really love technology, and I believe the future belongs to artificial intelligence. Of course, AI may not yet be able to fully replace hosts or every profession, but I hope young creators will explore and experiment with it. This year in China, the government officially approved the screening of AI-generated films, which shows how seriously China is embracing this technology and allowing it to play a major role in cinema. Even in documentary and short film production, the same applies. At this year's festival, I saw some works that seemed to be made with AI, but in some cases, it's still difficult to judge certain aspects clearly.
Right, and to complete that, of course, imagine you're busy making a documentary film, and then somebody, one of the crew members of your staff, comes and just shoots a part of it with a mobile phone, and you have to take like 3 months to edit and add narration and everything, but the guy in your team can post that small clip, that very short clip, on Instagram, on another social media platform in a matter of seconds. Does it kind of make social media more important, or does it kind of get some of the effect of cinema and documentary from it?
In this era of technological advancement and artificial intelligence, many tools like mobile phones have become incredibly useful. These days, we can often create an entire film using just the camera on our phone. In China, we frequently hold showcases and workshops focused on mobile filmmaking. Personally, I often shoot short videos on set using my phone. Everyone knows that short videos are extremely influential in China, and they've made a significant impact globally as well. So, if you're passionate about visuals and filmmaking, I truly believe that today you can absolutely create a short film or even a documentary using just a mobile phone. In fact, from what I experienced in this year's festival entries, I guess many of those films were shot on phones.
Right. What advice would you give to young aspiring documentary filmmakers?
Well, I truly believe that young filmmakers should start with what's around them, with the people in their lives and the subjects close to their everyday experiences. They should focus on familiar environments and familiar events. As you mentioned, using a mobile phone or working within the format of a short film is a great way to begin creating. In this process, you have to keep experimenting. You have to allow yourself to fail and move forward step by step. In the end, all you really need is love, vision, and hope. I believe that your dreams will eventually come true. You shouldn't give up in the face of hardship, and you shouldn't be afraid to fall. You just have to keep going.
Right, and are there any stories that you dream of making and still haven't had the chance yet?
Yes, I do. For example, I'm really interested in focusing on police and crime genres in filmmaking. It's an area I'd love to explore more deeply and understand better. But so far, I haven't had the time or the opportunity to connect with it or gain hands-on experience. I've also always been curious about many topics related to Iran, subjects I'd like to learn about and discover, but I haven't yet had the chance to dive into them.
Right. Well, Mr. Jean-Jung, it's a pleasure to have you on this program. As we approach the end of the show, of course, we have a few moments when you talk directly to our audience. Our audience will momentarily become yours, so feel free to share whatever you want with your audience now.
Hello everyone, I'm Zhang Zhong, a filmmaker from China. This is my first time visiting Iran, and I've come to Tehran to participate in the Sub-International Media Festival. I'm truly happy and honored to greet you all here. I wish you health and success in everything you do. And if the opportunity arises in the future, I warmly invite all of you to visit China. I'll be waiting for you in Beijing.
Mr. Jean-Jean, once again, thank you so much for taking the time and coming to SOAP. And thank you guys for staying with us on another conversation. This is SOAP. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, back on you.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of Truth.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to talk about different viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to elaborate and shed light on some of the points and lessons that this great character has made for us in order to make use of them in our daily lives as followers and true lovers of this great character. Well, about the subject of the month of Muharram, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam saw that the way to destroy the despots and break the tyrants consists of sacrificing lives, and this is Islam's leading instruction for all nations to the end of time. So you see, what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi meant in this part of his speech is the recommendation of Islam to sacrifice one's life for the sake of justice and religion. To make a sacrifice means to deprive oneself of something and to give something away for the sake of attaining a goal. It is to give away something, often precious, in order to achieve something greater. The goal of sacrifice is purification of the self and thereafter of society. A good society is made up of good people. A corrupt society, however, is made up of corrupt people. So in order to have a good society, we must purify ourselves and make sacrifices. If we are pure, our families will be pure so. One of the most beautiful examples we have of sacrifices is that of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, who was the doyen of the martyrs. The political situation in the life of the Imam was pretty much in many ways as it is today. They had a government and leadership that claimed to be Muslim but which were truly anti-Muslim. Yazid, who was the Caliph of the time, lived in extremely luxury. He was effeminate, wore silk, committed adultery, made fun of the Sharia, and was well known for his many corrupt practices. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was one of the greatest revolutionaries ever. Although he was not successful physically, he was successful spiritually and religiously. He caused an intellectual revolution and a revival of Islam. Through Imam Hussein's sacrifice, many people came to realize that the Islam of Yazid was not the true Islam, and many came into the path of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. This uprising gave strength to many and resulted in many following his example and leading bloody rebellions against oppressors and tyrants. That is the result of sacrifice for religion that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi made us aware about. May Allah bless the soul of this great man. Thank you very much for listening to us, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah take to all.
إلا الله. alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
May the peace, blessings, and mercy of God be with you all. These phrases have been widely shared on social media in the Arab world and in everyday conversations among people. While they arise in various contexts and moments, they raise two fundamental questions to understand the goals and significance of these slogans within a specific colonial context. The two questions are, from whom, in other words, from whom do we want to save Sheikh Jarrah, Gaza, and Sudan? Secondly, who, that is, who is willing to save Sheikh Jarrah, assist Gaza, and remember Sudan? Of course, not everyone who raises these slogans has the same answers, particularly regarding the second question. As for the first question, most would agree that saving Gaza, Al-Quds, or Sudan means freeing them from the hegemonic tools of the United States, such as the Zionist Project and its regional allies. Regarding the second question, if we were to ask it, we might receive responses such as, we should reach out to Arab and Islamic countries, we should appeal to the people, or even we should turn to the so-called international community. However, after long and bitter experiences, it is clear that most of those who promote these slogans are not addressing the mentioned entities. In fact, many do not direct their message to anyone specific. The lack of clarity about who is responsible for the rescue action, despite recognizing the problem and its causes, opens up a crucial debate, which can be summarized in the central question of this episode: who will confront Israel? Without a doubt, this question may seem odd, especially after 2 years of daily struggle on various fronts against the Israeli enemy. To prevent any misunderstandings, the focus here is forward-looking. Who will fight against Israel in the next phase? Before delving deeper into this idea, it's crucial to address the question, why do we consider it inevitable to confront the Israeli entity in the upcoming phase? In summary, and without going too much into detail, Israel's role in its hegemonic project is rooted in war, expansion, occupation, and subjugation. Even if everyone in the region were to accept the conditions set by the United States and grant Israel all the discussed guarantees, this would not change its role. On the contrary, it would facilitate its expansion, territorial occupation, and the enslavement of the peoples in the region. Therefore, the only viable option, even if it is not accepted by the majority, is military confrontation to deter Israeli expansion. For this reason, it is our right and duty to ask ourselves and to ask you, who will fight against Israel in the next phase? Why do we pose this question? There are several reasons. One, the work of Western hegemony over our countries and the world. The second reason relates to the current stance of American hegemony and the Zionist Project. Years ago, the United States aimed to establish Israel as the political, economic, and security hub of the region, thereby ensuring its dominance for decades, if not centuries. This was in direct conflict with the desire for confrontation, which peaked during the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood and the subsequent wars in Gaza, Lebanon, and Yemen. Before October 7, 2023, this conflict intensified U.S. efforts to position Israel as the regional hub. This push became particularly apparent towards the end of Donald Trump's first term, with the enforcement of normalization agreements known as the Abraham Accords on several U.S.-allied regimes, or more accurately, those subordinate to the U.S. in the region. It also compelled the U.S. to acknowledge Al-Quds and the occupied Syrian Golan Heights as Israeli territory, in quotation marks, of course. After October 7th, the United States chose to turn the threat into an opportunity to shift the existing balance of power between the American axis and the opposing axis, removing barriers to establish Israel as the absolute ruler of the region. This American axis has made significant strides, particularly in the renewed repression against the peoples and resistance forces, which have lost much of the deterrent equations that allowed them to operate for two decades. In the military and security realm, we find ourselves in a phase of impunity and freedom for the enemy to kill without a strong deterrent from the opposing side. This situation is the second reason, and perhaps the most significant, behind the question posed in this episode. Who will stand up to Israel? In other words, who will confront an expansionist entity that chooses to annihilate, has immunity and ammunition to do so, and currently possesses the land, security, and political superiority that places those who fight against it and anyone who gets in its way under the threat of impunity, persecution, and daily violence? To address the central question of this episode, it's essential to review the basic principles that explain why societies and individuals resort to struggle. Essentially, struggle serves as a means to achieve one of two fundamental goals: survival or expansion. Survival is the goal that drives a group or individual to fight for their existence and what defines their identity: land, family, home, among others. It's primarily a defensive struggle and does not require much complexity to justify it or to shape the psychological state that prompts someone to fight and sacrifice to achieve it. The defense of one's own existence is a universal human instinct, recognized even by international laws as legitimate self-defense. In this context, actions taken to preserve life in the face of an attack are not considered a crime, but rather an inherent right. The second goal of any group's struggle is expansion. This aim typically materializes after a group stabilizes, seeking to broaden its influence, gather resources, and achieve political objectives through control and power. However, despite the varying goals, expansion often appears as a defensive strategy. For instance, attacking others in their territories before they reach us, with a motivation that is fundamentally offensive. This approach has endured throughout history, from the Roman Empire to modern times, with American invasions following World War II serving as a clear example. Campaigns like George W. Bush's in Afghanistan, under the guise of fighting terrorism, or the intervention in Iraq based on the false claim of weapons of mass destruction, and even Donald Trump's rhetoric against Venezuela, using the fight against drugs as a pretext, illustrate how expansion is justified through defensive narratives. In the past, expansionist campaigns were primarily founded on two pillars: absolute loyalty to the ruling regime and direct material gains. These incentives motivated individuals and groups to engage in combat without a clear self-defense objective. However, there is a third phenomenon, less common yet equally powerful: ideological struggle. In this instance, individuals internalize an idea or cause to the extent that it becomes a genuine motivation to fight and make sacrifices, even when it does not directly impact their survival or future. We mention these points to highlight that the motivations of any group to fight are fundamentally based on the preservation of the group through self-defense or the defense of their privileges and way of life through expansion, control, and influence. If we analyze the situation in our region, we can see that since World War I, the Arab peoples have been in a constant state of self-defense against the Zionist enemy and the hegemonic system that supports it. The aggression comes from one side, the American-Israeli side, whose dominance is based on the plundering of our resources, the occupation of our land, and the enslavement of our people. The relationship that governs us with the other side, the American-Israeli side, is one of victimization, that is us, and aggressor, that is them. This is not related to a border dispute or a disagreement over resource distribution. Rather, the core of the relationship lies in how each side defines its position within it. In other words, the United States and Israel believe that the extermination and subjugation of our people, along with the plundering of our resources, are essential for their survival and ongoing presence in the world. This is relatively true, as an occupier cannot continue to occupy unless they eliminate all original inhabitants. Therefore, the peoples of the region fighting against the invaders, regardless of their form or scale, is a legitimate act of self-defense because, quite simply, it is a means to repel extermination and slavery. Of course, the question that some might ask upon hearing this obvious statement is, if things are so clear, simple, and evident, why do we discuss them? We discuss them because despite all the moral, legal, and political legitimacy available to confront Israel, the act of fighting Israel remains limited to a very small segment of the population compared to the number targeted by the Israeli project and its hegemonic ambitions. The most revealing example is the active support for the Palestinian people during the genocide following October 7, 2023. Despite the seriousness of the situation, less than 10% of the Muslim societies, the primary target of the Zionist project, mobilized actively in their defense. So where does the problem lie? Why does the Muslim world, being the target of the Zionist project, not confront this threat collectively? To answer this question, we propose a series of hypotheses. The first and most logical one is the inability. This is a response we often hear, but the examples from the war in Syria after 2011, along with those of Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and other organizations in Iraq, Yemen, Libya, and other countries, show that a significant number of young Arabs and Muslims are being recruited, trained, and mobilized to fight under their banners. To put it more clearly, the very societies that claim they cannot equip or send fighters against the Zionist project and U.S. hegemony are the same ones that have produced and deployed tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of fighters in wars that they have never confronted, nor will they confront Israel. Therefore, the hypothesis of incapacity does not hold up to scrutiny. The second hypothesis suggests that there is no hostility towards Israel. This perspective is also quite unfair, as the sentiment of rejection towards Israel runs deep within societies of the region, particularly following the genocidal escalation against the Palestinian people after October 7, 2023, and the Israeli arrogance in occupying Arab territories. While some regions have made progress in political normalization, popular normalization remains a marginal phenomenon. However, there's also a lack of organized resistance against this normalization in most Arab and Islamic countries. In other words, the hypothesis that there is no hostility towards Israel does not explain the situation either. So how do we explain it? In fact, the most logical hypothesis to account for the lack of struggle is a combination of both, which we could refer to as the hypothesis of acquired incapacity. Acquired incapacity refers to a state of psychological paralysis that convinces an individual of their helplessness, even when they possess the means to take action. This illusion arises from two key factors. The first and most important is a